Good morning. It is still morning.
Morning.
We've had, the panel has previously been introduced. While you're setting up, I'm going to ask our marshal to call the next case.
The third case is A24-0573, State of Minnesota Appellant versus John Trail Wesley Dawson Respondent.
I recognize that counsel is familiar with appellate procedure. I just want to remind you to say, indicate who you are and which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your arguments. Take your time. I also want to point out the podium has been adjusted by one of the attorneys in a prior case. There's a counter button if you want to move it down or adjust it to your height preference. And we started rather abruptly, so take your time. When you're ready, appellant counsel, you can approach the podium.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and with me at counsel table is my co-counsel, Jacqueline Fogel, and we represent Appellant State of Minnesota in this appeal. I have roaches all through that car. That's what respondent told Officer Judd when Judd asked him if he had pot in his car, which was parked on a public street. But despite this admission, and despite the fact that Judd smelled a pungent odor of freshly burned marijuana coming from inside respondent's vehicle, the district court granted respondent's motion to suppress evidence found during the subsequent search of respondent's vehicle. But because these facts provided Judd with probable cause to believe that respondent's vehicle contained contraband, the district court erred when it granted respondent's motion to suppress, and the state respectfully asked this court to reverse the district court. Here, the district court concluded that while respondent was seized when Judd asked him to step out of the vehicle and talk to him, that seizure was supported by a reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity based on the odor of freshly burned marijuana coming from respondent's vehicle. But the district court then went on to hold that the officer did not have the same reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity necessary to justify asking respondent to consent to a search of the vehicle.
You disagree that Mr. Dawson was seized when the officer asked him to get out of the vehicle?
I do disagree with the district court's conclusion on that point, yes.
Okay, so, and I know your brief focuses on the fact that it was presented to Mr. Dawson by the officer as more of a question than a request, right?
Correct.
What I noticed you skipped over in your brief was the statement by the officer that was more of a direction. I think Mr. Erickson pointed this out in his brief, where he points to the sedan and said, "Let's go over here." And so you would agree that's a directive statement, correct?
It is a directive statement. I think when you listen to the tenor of it, it's directive in the sense that it ends with a period rather than a question mark.
So it wasn't a question.
It wasn't a question. I agree with that. Yes.
Why doesn't that, even if we were to agree with you and your characterization of the cases and that the simple request to get out of a vehicle isn't enough to transform the encounter into a seizure, why isn't that additional statement conclusive evidence that this was a seizure?
And I think the answer to that is pretty straightforward. It's not conduct that goes significantly beyond that expected in ordinary social intercourse to constitute a show of authority. You might be talking with somebody and suggest that you move away to talk somewhere with privacy. And so that's not the kind of show of authority.
Well, I mean,
that the case law has.
Talking to somebody is a lot different than speaking to a police officer on the side of the road. And if a police officer in full uniform who's parked his squad behind another car says, let's go over here, wouldn't you agree that most people would come to the conclusion that they are not free to leave?
I don't know that I would agree that most people would come to the conclusion that they're not free to disobey that order. I think it depends a lot on the tone of the conversation, and that's why I pointed out the tone here was very friendly, very non-confrontational. And I think the Supreme Court has made it clear that you have to have conduct by the officer that goes significantly beyond that which would be expected in ordinary social intercourse. And asking somebody to maybe move to a slightly different location to talk with them isn't conduct that goes beyond that in ordinary social intercourse. In business situations or maybe out in the hallway here at the Judicial Center, you might be talking and want privacy and ask somebody, you know, can we step over here or let's go over there, which would be more like what's going on here.
I need you to clarify a portion of the record. Judge Malley, in his omnibus order said, Judd found the situation suspicious. This is when he separated them. Specifically in light of information given by the narcotics team. But during cross-examination, he admitted that his report didn't have any details regarding the narcotics investigator before he approached the vehicles. So was there any determination made as to whether he had this information or not? Was it ever fleshed out by any other testimony?
So he did testify that he had this information before he approached the vehicle.
But then on cross-examination, he said no.
Well, I think on cross-examination, he said he didn't include that information in his report.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you. That's the distinction I was looking for.
Can I follow up on that? Because you have argued that the district court erred in, the district court used the term suppressing the information from investigator. Is it Hole or Hool?
Hool.
Hool. And that, you know, part of the reason is it was somewhat of an ambush because the defense attorney didn't include in his initial motion to suppress a request to suppress Investigator Hool's statements. But of course, what distinguishes this case, you'd agree, from Needham, is that the defense didn't know that Investigator Hool had said this because it wasn't in any of the testifying officers' reports. Do you agree that evidence of Investigator Hool's statements were never turned over to the defense?
I don't think there's any record that they were turned over to the defense. There certainly, I agree, they weren't included in the reports. So,
I mean, we do have, yeah, and we have evidence at the hearing that Judge Werke was just referring to that the testifying officer said, I didn't include any of that, right?
Right,
so
right.
What are we to make of that? And tell me why that doesn't completely distinguish this from Needham and Hewitt and the other cases that you cite, where this isn't a new theory of suppression that's being advanced. This is, I didn't actually have this evidence, and although the district court doesn't cite it, this is a Rule 9 violation. You were obligated to give this to me before the hearing. You didn't give it to me, and I understand that it's an extreme sanction to exclude it, but certainly that's within the district court's discretion. Why isn't this different from those cases in that context?
I think it's different because the objection that was raised that the state had an opportunity to address at the hearing was simply a hearsay objection, and there were arguments made on the record about that. If the defendant had made an objection under a Rule 9 basis during the hearing or at some point in time before the state submitted its memorandum and we would have had an opportunity to actually address that, I think that would make it different than Needham. But because the issue was, and I understand there's surprise all around, right? The state didn't disclose what should have been disclosed, and But the defendant didn't then turn around to make a Rule 9 objection, didn't make any other objection other than a hearsay objection in a way that allowed the state to respond to the specific objection.
How would the state have responded to a Rule 9 objection because the state hadn't turned it over?
Right. Well, I mean, there could have been a number of possibilities. There could have been a continuance. So if we had an objection during the course of the omnibus hearing to a Rule 9 objection, there could have been a continuance of the omnibus hearing to allow the disclosure and then allow the defendant to be able to make the arguments they want to make about whether that information.
Would have been in the judge's discretion to say you were supposed to turn everything over before now, you didn't, and so I'm not going to allow any testimony about it. That would have been in the judge's discretion.
It would have been in the judge's discretion, but the parties are entitled to notice and an opportunity to be heard about the arguments and what theories the court's going to rule on, and that's fundamentally what Needham stands for.
Well, why wouldn't we just presume the reason the state never made any other attempt to submit anything on this is the fact that the state didn't ever turn over this evidence, and there actually wasn't any written reports of these statements, which would have been required under Rule 9?
Because appellate courts don't assume things.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Let's assume that the district court erred and should have relied on this information. Why is the testimony that came in about Investigator Houle sufficient for reasonable, articulable suspicion? Because it seems to me that what was actually said is that Mr. Dawson's vehicle was under surveillance for an ongoing drug investigation. That's not, I believe there's drugs in the car. He's under surveillance. And then there could be a high probability of a large amount of drugs in one of these vehicles at the location. So the way I look at that is there may be a high probability that you or Mr. Erickson has a stick of gum in your pocket. But as I'm sitting here, would that be more than a hunch that one of you has gum?
That fact taken by itself, no. But I think what's important to remember is we're looking at the totality of the circumstances here. And the state's not arguing that fact by itself makes reasonable articulable suspicion here. The state's arguing that fact should have been included in the totality of the circumstances, and that when it's combined with the rest of the specific observations that Officer Judd made, it certainly is enough to take this beyond a mere hunch, whim, or idle curiosity.
Do you agree that the information isn't particularized as to Mr. Dawson? I mean, there's a possibly in one of two vehicles, there's drugs.
Certainly, it's not particularized as to Mr. Dawson, but first of all, I think the important thing, well, it's not particularized as to Mr. Dawson. The suspicion becomes further particularized with the officer's specific observations of the odor of freshly burned marijuana coming from the vehicle and each subsequent observation.
Well, drugs is really general. There's going to be a large amount of drugs in the car. So is that roaches? I mean, is it marijuana? We don't know if it was methamphetamine or heroin or cocaine. And then secondly, is 6.5 grams a large amount?
Well, I don't think we look at the end result of the search to ask whether the information was accurate.
I don't know
what
a large amount is to Officer Houle or Judd.
And again, I mean, if those were arguments that the defendant was going to make about the weight that fact should be given with regard to its contribution to the totality of the circumstances, those are arguments that should have been made and had. But
so,
because
the totality of circumstances at the point that the officer who orders Mr. Dawson out of the car or asks him to get out are what Investigator Houle said, high crime area with the break-ins to the storage units and the odor of marijuana. Did I miss anything there?
Well, so
I miss that they're shirtless and braless in the back seat working on their relationship.
Right, that's a whole different story. But I mean, to support asking him to get out, do you agree it's those three things? Am I missing something?
So with Judge Riley's additions, I think, so you've got the time of day, it's 8:30, they've had specifically testimony about daylight break-ins, and Houle even says...
Do you agree the shirtless being in the back, that really kind of eliminated the suspicion that they were involved in breaking into any storage lockers there? It was pretty obvious what was going on.
Well, it may well have eliminated that suspicion, but it certainly is still suspicious. And it contributes to the totality of the circumstances. I don't think there's any, I mean, it's unusual behavior.
Suspicious in what way? Of what crime? Suspicious of what crime?
Well, I suppose it could be suspicious that there may be indecent exposure going on at some point in time.
That's not part of a drug investigation.
Well, it is not part of a drug investigation, but it is, reasonable articulable suspicion doesn't need to be that pinpointed at the time we're asking somebody to step out of a car. When we're talking about consent to
a certain kind of crime, I would think.
I think the case law says that a reasonable articulable suspicion of that criminal activity is afoot.
That's a crime, right?
But it's crimes generalized. I mean, the officer doesn't have to identify.
The storage lockers were a block away. I mean, it wasn't as if they were parked adjacent to the storage lockers, so I don't know if the fact that it was a high crime area justifies the officer's activity. I mean, well, how do you tie that in because of the time and the distance?
Yeah, I think the time
it's about winter, so they're clearly could walk there and.
Yes, but and the officer also testified that one of the kinds of crimes that contributed to this being a high crime area was drug crimes. So it's not just limited to break-ins. And there was an ongoing narcotics investigation in the area.
Can I ask you one more question before your time runs out? So in Torgerson, the Supreme Court didn't really reach the issue of whether or not there would be reasonable suspicion because the defendant, based on the odor of marijuana to detain a defendant, right? Because the defendant had forfeited that. But the Supreme Court favorably talked about Burbach, the odor of alcohol case, where the conclusion was the odor of alcohol emanating from a passenger wasn't enough to justify the search of the passenger compartment for an open container. Do you agree, in light of the Supreme Court's favorable treatment of Burbach in Torgerson, that this odor of alcohol, odor of marijuana is not enough, coming from a vehicle is not enough to detain someone, that in and of itself, by itself?
Judge Warkey, my time's expired. May I answer?
Answer Judge Eads' question.
I don't disagree that based on the treatment of Burbach in Torgerson that the Supreme Court would reach that conclusion, that the odor of marijuana isn't coming from a vehicle parked on a public street, the odor of freshly burned marijuana coming from a vehicle parked on a public street is not enough to detain the person to investigate further. And that's especially true because after Torgerson, Minnesota's laws governing the possession and use of marijuana in motor vehicles actually became more restrictive. It's now a misdemeanor to possess any amount of marijuana, loose marijuana, in a motor vehicle on a public street. That's a crime, not a petty misdemeanor. And it's also a misdemeanor to use marijuana in a motor vehicle on a public street or highway. If the odor coming from the vehicle doesn't give reasonable articulable suspicion to investigate those crimes further.
Sorry.
Judge Eads has one last question and then we'll wrap it up.
But it was a crime to have an open container, so why does that distinction matter?
I think that
in Burbach.
I think the distinction matters in first of all, in Burbach, the odor was pinpointed to a passenger. It was coming from the passenger, not coming from the vehicle generally. So that's an important distinction that the Supreme Court drew in Burbach. I also think that the fact that the use of marijuana in a motor vehicle is illegal, as well as the possession of any amount is illegal. You have to have reasonable articulable suspicion to investigate. I mean, otherwise, these laws that the legislature has enacted are unenforceable, quite frankly.
You'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you for responding to the questions as posed. Respondent counsel, you have the floor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the respondent this morning, Mr. Dawson. We are requesting that this court affirm the district court's order suppressing the evidence obtained during the warrantless search of the vehicle and affirm the district court's decision to dismiss the charge for lack of probable cause. I think it's easiest to break up the discussion this morning into two sections. One, the initial seizure, and then whether there was reasonable suspicion. As was discussed in this case, it is clear that Mr. Dawson was seized after he was asked to leave the car, exit the car, walk to the back of the vehicle, and then asked again and directed to walk to the squad car. At that point, it's a reasonable person would not believe that they were free to terminate the encounter. I can't think of any two citizens who would interact that way, where someone would knock on the window with a gun and a badge and ask them to exit, and then ask them to move two different times to a squad car where they were discussing possible crimes in the area along with marijuana use. This wasn't just an innocent encounter of a police officer walking up and asking a few questions and then walking away, which would not be a seizure. So in this case, it's clear that Mr. Dawson was seized before there was any discussion regarding roaches. The only evidence at that point was the smell of marijuana, along with them sitting in the back seat of the car, shirtless, in a location where there had, at some point, at some time, been some criminal activity blocks away.
And at 8:15 in the morning, which, as the judge in this case made a determination, that's not necessarily a crime time of day.
That's correct. And I would also say that, you know, at the time the officer approached the vehicles, he didn't have any idea what was going on inside the vehicles, and two vehicles back to back, there may be something going on, but as soon as he had that encounter with them, they were calm, they were articulate, they explained why they were there. There's nothing to do with breaking into any sort of buildings. No one had seen them walking away from the vehicle. Their story added up, them sitting in the back of the vehicle discussing their relationship or whatever they were doing had nothing to do with any sort of criminal activity.
Say we disagree with the discovery sanction suppression decision of the district court to not consider Investigator Houle's information. Why isn't what Investigator Houle provided to the arresting officer enough to detain, just for the detention piece?
Right, and I think it was discussed previously, it was only a hunch, there were only assumptions, and there were only allegations. There were no facts supporting any of those statements. It was just, there might be drugs being dealt between vehicles here. We don't know where that information came from. There's no articulable facts supporting that. If a police officer drives down the street and sees a black car, calls another cop and says, I think there's drugs in that car, that doesn't change the dynamic just because one officer says it to another. They would have to explain what facts actually establish that suspicion. And we don't have any of those facts in this case. We don't know if there was an informant, if they had been monitoring, if something had happened the night before. There's no facts at all. So it would have required that officer to come in, testify, provide some information as to where that information came from or that allegation. So right now, all we have is a hunch, and that doesn't establish reasonable suspicion.
Go ahead.
I'm going to switch the questioning if you want to follow up.
Oh, that's okay.
So Mr. Smith says that Torgerson is pre-change of the 23 statutes. How do you respond to that? He says now that the legislature has tightened the statutes about marijuana in cars, and therefore what the officers, I don't want to put words in his mouth, what I think he's saying is therefore what the officers saw was evidence of a crime, misdemeanor.
Yeah, I'm going to just take a couple steps back because I think something was missed in that earlier discussion, and that is at the time the officer approached the vehicle, Mr. Dawson said that he had a medical marijuana license. That was not contested. He didn't ask any more questions about it. It was assumed that he had that license. The statute is clear that someone with a medical marijuana license can smoke marijuana inside a vehicle. That is not a crime. It has to be on the road or on the highway. And I think there does need to be more education, just generally speaking, in the criminal justice system as to what officers should do when they approach vehicles now because of medical marijuana laws, that it is different. And when you walk up to a car and you smell marijuana, you don't see any marijuana, you don't see it being smoked, and the person says, I have a medical marijuana license, and there's no other discussion about it, at that point, there is no evidence of a crime. It is completely innocent.
It's a defense, right? But why isn't it enough for reasonable suspicion to detain, right? I mean, that, like in the gun context, you know, when we talk about like Timberlake, right? Mm-hmm. Someone might have a permit to have a gun and just, but the Supreme Court has said the mere fact of a report, someone having a gun in public isn't defeated by the possibility that they may be a permit holder.
That's true in that context, but I think here where it was specifically stated by Mr. Dawson to the police officer that he had a card and the police officer didn't do anything about it, didn't ask any other questions, and then later on during the interaction, he kept reminding Mr. Dawson, hey, it's fine. It's not illegal for you to have marijuana. He said that four or five times throughout the encounter. So I think it's different than if someone has a firearm on them and then is charged with a crime and then says, oh, you know, I could have had a permit at that time. The state had to disprove that at trial. I think that's very different than a situation where it's articulated to the police officer. The officer clearly heard it, and the officer believed him and didn't testify that he didn't believe him, and then went on to further the investigation. And again, even if at that point it was unclear whether he had a marijuana license, there's no evidence of when marijuana was smoked, where it was smoked, or anything of that. So there's no evidence at that point that would give him suspicion that they're committing a crime at that moment.
Well, it seems to me like Supreme Court Torgerson's adoption of Burbach is helpful to you, but Mr. Smith, I think, points out that Burbach is a little factually distinct because the odor of alcohol was pinpointed as emanating from a passenger, and the Supreme Court deemed that wasn't sufficient to then expand the attention. Although I will acknowledge that Torgerson seems to very broadly generalize from that rule to the idea that there's, you know, Burbach stands for the proposition that there's no reasonable suspicion to detain someone based on odor alone. And what do you make of all that?
I agree with that, and I think that actually helps us because Mr. Dawson's sitting in the back seat. He's not driving at that moment. That whole discussion was regarding whether or not the driver was possibly driving under the influence, and that kind of distinction between a passenger and the driver. And him sitting in the back seat and the fact that it was a smell in the car itself, I don't think that that's distinguishable from someone holding a beer or holding a marijuana joint. I think that actually helps us because we don't know where that marijuana smell came from, when it was smoked, any of that information, whereas in the other case, it is specific to him holding the beer at that time. So I think that does help us in the discussion of Torgerson. You know, the general conclusion in Torgerson is that you have to look at the totality of the circumstances and that there are not bright line rules. And in this case, because if you look at the totality of the circumstances, the information the officer had regarding his marijuana license, the lack of any other evidence that there were drugs in the car or that they were committing any other crime, you look at that all together, that the totality of those circumstances does not establish reasonable suspicion to seize him at that moment. If I can move on to then the next part. So when he was first seized, there was no discussion of the roaches, right? At that point, it was just the smell of marijuana alone. So we move on beyond that. And then when the officer actually asks for consent to search the vehicle, the only reason he wants to search the vehicle is for roaches. It's not for a large quantity of marijuana.
But before you go to that point, do we need to get to this if we agree with you that the detention was, that there was a detention when he's asked to get out and that there wasn't reasonable articulable suspicion?
No.
Or is the consent that's later given an intervening cause that would preclude the use of the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine to exclude the evidence that's ultimately found in the car?
It's not. As soon as that illegal seizure took place where he was seized outside the vehicle, the analysis there stops. And any other information obtained, including requesting consent, does not interrupt the fruit of the poisonous tree. It ends at the point of the unconstitutional seizure without reasonable suspicion. There's nothing that would interrupt that subsequent. And it's also based on new information, a new analysis, and whether or not the request for consent. It's not like Mr. Dawson drove away, stopped, came back, and said, hey, you can search my vehicle or something like that. And the reason why I agree that it stops at that point, I'm just trying to cover all my bases in case we get to the next step of the analysis, and that is that the officer testified multiple times that the only reason he searched the vehicle and the only thing he was looking for were marijuana roaches. And it's our position that searching a vehicle, requesting consent to search a vehicle for cigarette butts, is not, there's no reasonable suspicion of a crime taking place at that point, and that is unreasonable to ask for consent to search for something that is not a crime, and it doesn't meet the threshold of being a crime. And like I said before, the officer didn't have any articulable suspicion that there was any other crime taking place at that point. The officer waited 20 minutes after receiving information about these roaches to finally request consent to search the car. The officer was just waiting and waiting and trying to get some sort of more information from Mr. Dawson or his girlfriend, and it didn't happen. Searched Mr. Dawson's girlfriend's car. There was nothing in it. At that point, it didn't seem like they were going to terminate the encounter at any point until there was a search of the vehicle. That gets to the next step of whether the actual consent was valid.
Like Mr. Smith pointed out, this was a pretty conversational interaction. There was not really any sort of browbeating or, you know, he's not placed in handcuffs in the back of the car. But for the prolonged detention argument that you're making, it would seem to me to be, you're a little hard pressed, wouldn't you agree, on the consent being invalid? He says, yeah, it's cool with me, or something along those lines, right?
Yeah, I agree that the words he states on their own, if we would just say that, we would not say that that's invalid or that he hesitated or anything like that. Our position is, and what the district court found, which is a factual finding, is that the delay in requesting consent and that whole time period, that's what resulted in him being felt or feeling like he had to consent in order to terminate the encounter. I agree. That question and answer, it was definitely not a pressured question or any sort of you have to consent to this or else something's going to happen. It wasn't anything like that. But it was just the overall circumstances the district court found factually that by the time it got to that point, there was nothing Mr. Dawson could do but consent to the search.
So let me ask you this. I just want to make sure that you didn't appeal the and there'd be no reason for you to appeal, but...
That's usually the question I get on the other side, but...
Yeah, I know. The motion to suppress based on the unlawful seizure, the district court denied that motion for you, found that the seizure was lawful.
The initial seizure, or...
The initial seizure.
Not the initial seizure. The initial encounter was not a seizure. So the office, the defense attorney argued that the police officer walking up to the car or parking the car, walking up on its own was a seizure, and the district court found that that was not a seizure.
It wasn't like it was blocking the people's car or anything like that.
Right. So it wasn't a traffic stop, right? The car was already parked. The police officer.
Do you agree with that?
We are not contesting that initial finding before he asked him to exit the vehicle. That itself wasn't a seizure. The officer was well within his right to walk up and ask a couple questions. Without any more information, the officer should have left.
And so you agree with the district court's second order, which is that the motion to suppress the expansion of the scope and the duration of the seizure.
That's right.
Was granted, okay.
That's right, yep. And like I said, I the officer could have left, monitored the situation from afar, done something like that to see if there was actually some sort of drug deal going on, which didn't take place. That's our position. So, yeah, if the court doesn't have any other questions.
I do have one other question. It doesn't have to do with the merits of the case. It looks like you've left the appellate public defenders and you're out on your own. Is that right?
Part-time.
Oh, part-time.
Yep. 0.75 public defender, then private on the side and doing some federal public defender work too. So.
And so you're doing this in your private capacity?
That's right.
Okay,
that's
thank
right.
you.
If there are any more questions on the case?
An excellent question.
There
appears to be
I'll
no
be here
other
a lot
questions.
Still.
And Mr. Smith's probably going to start off his rebuttal contesting that or something.
All right, thank you, Mr. Erickson. And Mr. Smith, you have the last word.
Respondent's asking this court to ignore the facts and to ignore the law. His argument...
Let's talk about that marijuana card. That got my attention. So, you know, you heard the argument. What do you say about that?
That's essentially where I was going to go here. Because the medical marijuana card is, first of all, a self-serving assertion made by a criminal defendant. So the officer is not obligated to believe that. I agree with Judge Ede that that is more akin to a permit to carry and something that may be essentially an affirmative defense to a charge, but it does not dispel reasonable articulable suspicion. The law is crystal clear that innocent explanations for conduct do not dispel reasonable articulable suspicion. And I also think it's important to note that a medical marijuana card does not authorize somebody to possess marijuana, any amount of marijuana, loose in a motor vehicle on a public street or highway. And the facts of this case are that the respondent's vehicle was parked on a public street or highway when the officer smelled the odor of freshly burned marijuana coming from the vehicle. Respondent argues that there's no evidence of when it was smoked. There is no evidence, if you ignore the evidence in the record, that it was an odor of freshly burned marijuana. It's reasonable based on that odor to infer that it was smoked in the vehicle. In fact, when the officer walks up to the vehicle, the windows are down.
My issue is with the arguments you've been making on this is that I don't know how these arguments get around what the Supreme Court said in characterizing Burbach in Torgerson, because, you know, the idea that the law may have changed on August 1st, 2023, I don't know that it's that helpful to you, because, like I said earlier, open container was a criminal violation, and the Supreme Court said Burbach is helpful to our analysis here because it shows that reasonable suspicion, which requires a lesser showing than probable cause, did not exist when the only evidence of wrongdoing was the odor of alcohol. I don't know what to do with that if I am trying to rule in your favor, because it seems to me if we're reading that and narrowly applying what the people upstairs are telling us, we have to affirm here.
Well, I will go back to the distinction I made that the odor there was pinpointed to an adult passenger who could have legally consumed alcohol. I think that's an important fact in the Burbach analysis, because the analysis discusses, because if you smell the odor of alcohol generally coming from the vehicle or coming from the driver, right?
But isn't it a crime to have an open container of alcohol in a car, whether or not the driver has it in his possession or the passenger? It doesn't matter. So if someone's smelling alcohol, recently consumed alcohol in a car, and that's not enough to expand a detention,
but
then why wouldn't the same thing apply here?
But that's not what Burbach says. Burbach says that the odor of alcohol coming that's attributable to an adult passenger does not provide reasonable articulable suspicion to detain the driver. Right?
I mean,
if the odor was coming generally from the vehicle, as opposed to being able to be pinpointed to as an odor of mouth alcohol from the passenger, then I think we have a different scenario. I think
but neither are the drivers here; they're in the back seat.
they are in the back seat. But the fact that the odor is coming from the vehicle generally, and it's a crime to possess that in the vehicle, gives an officer a reasonable basis to detain people to investigate further the crime that may be occurring.
The officer didn't want to investigate that. That was no big deal to him.
Well, that's not the respondent's position, and it doesn't matter what the officer wanted to investigate. What matters is what the objective facts would allow a reasonable officer to conclude. The officer's subjective motivation and subjective intent is completely irrelevant to the reasonable articulable suspicion or probable cause analysis. That's clear from the.
Except that the officer has to be able to articulate what his reasonable suspicion was.
He has to articulate the facts. He doesn't have to articulate that it led me to believe this crime was occurring. If those facts in the abstract would support an objective belief that a particular crime was occurring, it doesn't matter if the officer knew or didn't know whether that was the crime.
Well, so it doesn't matter that he said, I'm not interested in you and your roaches.
My time's expired. It does not matter. I would ask this court to reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Smith and Mr. Erickson. Sometimes it's nice that we have a case presented that we can have a little bit of fun with. So the matter is submitted. A decision will be issued in 90 days. Thank you for appearing today.